Black faces in high places are not gonna save us. Just look at the black proponents of Cop City in Atlanta's leadership class. Black faces in high places are not gonna save us. Just look at the black woman's hand, ambassador at the UN, voting against a ceasefire in Gaza. That is, our blackness and our womanness are not in themselves trustworthy. If we allow ourselves to be conscripted into positions of power that maintain the oppressive status quo, our blackness and womanness are not themselves trustworthy if we support the occupation of black neighborhoods with so-called better trained police, or remain silent about the genocide of oppressed peoples around the world funded by our tax dollars. And here, let me please shout out the incredible Spelman students and AUC siblings who have been organizing with Stop Cop City and Justice in Palestine, among many other troublemakers in this room. You all remind us that college is not a waiting room to enter the real world, but that you can start transforming that world right here, right now. It goes without saying, but let me just say it anyway. For student activists speaking out courageously for Palestine and Congo and Haiti and to stop Cop City, they should not be threatened with expulsion, loss of scholarships, or have public safety called on them for protesting. Too often, our institutions celebrate student activists after they've graduated. Even giving them honorary degrees.
Yes, folks. That was Rua Benjamin, professor at Princeton, receiving an honorary degree at Spelman and bringing the energy that, frankly, a lot more educators should be bringing to this moment and are failing to do so. We are live a little bit early with this episode 165 of Left Reckoning. Hello, David. Do you want to tell people why?
Yes, brother. We are live early because we have a very special guest, Dr. Asal Rod, on the program, return guest to Left Reckoning. We appreciate very much finding some time to sit here and talk to us because we have a very important story to talk about, which is the events over the weekend. And we want to make sure that we were bringing the level of analysis that all of y'all like here at Left Reckoning. And I can think of anyone better to do that than our friend Asal. Thank you so much for joining us on Left Reckoning today.
Thank you for having me back and having this discussion.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I know there's a lot to get to. And again, you know, folks, there are links below. You should definitely be following Asal on Twitter if you aren't already. This is somebody who is, you know, an incredible scholar and a very good voice. And, you know, there's a lot of things we can get into. But before, you know, we maybe jump into talking about Palestine more broadly, I wanted to talk and ask you where things currently stand. As folks who are watching this episode know, there were strikes by Iran on Israel over the weekend. And I was just curious if you could just sort of set the stage for folks, you know, what's been going on the past few days.
Sure. So one thing to keep in mind when we're talking about sort of starting points of things is there's been a shadow war between Iran and Israel that now goes back very many years. Israel sees Iran as an existential threat, and vice versa, Iran sees in many ways the same thing, right? So it's often a matter of perspective. From, you know, the, for instance, like assassinations by Israel of Iranian scientists, these are civilian scientists, obviously, inside of the country have go back more than a decade, starting back in 2010. So this is not entirely new, but there are some things that we should understand in this specific context and what's unprecedented about it. First of all, from the October 7th attacks by Hamas on Israel and the ensuing war on Gaza by Israel, there's been this tension in the region, right? People are very afraid that things will, it's sort of a matchbox that's waiting to be lit. And I think in some ways it's naive to think about it that way, because it's already spreading. The conflict has not been confined to Gaza. And the other part of that is, when we talk about Gaza, it's impossible to talk about Gaza without talking about with the West Bank, East Jerusalem, the Palestinian diaspora. It is not an individual issue when it comes to Gaza. It is the issue of Palestinian liberation and self-determination. And so all of these things are sort of intertwined. Now, there have been, in these last 6 months, some attacks by Iran-aligned groups in Iraq and Syria and Yemen against U.S. targets. The U.S. has responded in kind. And we saw about maybe 6 weeks ago, I think, an attack that killed 3 U.S. service members in Jordan. After that, the U.S. responded in kind. What happened, though, after that is you saw a sort of cooling of those attacks. U.S. assets were not attacked for very many weeks. And then at the first of this month, we saw Israel attack a Iranian consulate in Damascus, in Syria. So now Israel is bombing an Iranian embassy complex in another sovereign country. The reaction to this was obviously from the Iranian side that this was an unprecedented attack against one of its embassies or an embassy complex. What happened, though, on the U.S. side and the Western side was no condemnation for Israel's actions. Instead, now for 2 weeks, you still see the U.S. debating whether or not the action was even illegal, even though the consensus when it comes to international law, when you listen to experts, is an attack on a consulate would absolutely be deemed illegal. And so what we saw over the weekend was the Iranian response to that specific attack on its embassy complex in Damascus. And now, as far as the Iranian side is concerned, and this is something that they've said openly, the matter is closed. But of course, the matter is only closed if Israel decides not to retaliate after what happened over the weekend. But one of the things to also keep in mind in the attack is, in certain ways, it sort of parallels what happened in early 2020, for those of us who remember, when the US assassinated an Iranian general, Qasem Soleimani. Iran responded by firing missiles at a U.S. base in Iraq, but it telegraphed this attack. And so it made sure, essentially, and there were no casualties in that attack. And the Trump administration at the time sort of left it at that. So it was a tit for tat situation, and it didn't escalate further. Mm-hmm. That's somewhat the thinking, I think, that is informing what Iran did in the situation as well. We knew there are reports that, and this has been confirmed by foreign ministers from countries like Jordan, that Iran had informed other states of what it was planning to do, had given advance notice. The foreign minister of Jordan was clear in saying that that was the case. And Jordan is, in fact, one of the countries that helped to intercept many of the drones and missiles that were headed towards Israel. So there was, and this is according to Israel itself, there was very little damage, no casualties. And so this is a measured response to show from the Iranian side that there is going to be a response if Iran is attacked, and they see their argument is that an attack on a consulate is like an attack on its own soil. And what's unprecedented, though, again, is that despite all of this sort of rhetoric that we've seen in all of these decades and the shadow war that has existed for very many years, this is the first time Iran has actually attacked Israeli soil. Mm-hmm. So that's why the level of tension has reached this sort of crescendo where people are very worried that it might escalate into a confrontation between these two states. And specifically, if you're an American, the fact that the U.S. will be dragged into yet another forever war in the Middle East.
Well, you know, I think it's notable too that what you said about the fact that, you know, Iran did sort of telegraph this strike, which is something very different from what Israel did when it bombed the Iranian consulate, right? In fact, they told the Americans right before they did it, you know, which is, again, just like for Americans listening to this, I think it's really important to remember the relationship that we have with Israel as it continues to act in a very, very hawkish and hostile manner, one to the other countries in the region, and certainly to the Palestinians in Gaza.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, that's something to keep in mind is right now this entire, when you heard, so let me say it this way, when Iran's consulate was initially attacked, there was even a question last Friday, I believe it was, in a State Department briefing, where the state spokesperson, Matthew Miller, was asked by a journalist, this is before the attacks, the Iranian attacks, was asked, well, the Iranians have stated that no response would be necessary if the UN, if the US would essentially allow the UN to condemn Israel's action against its consulate. And the US didn't allow this, of course. When Iran wanted a condemnation from the United Nations, the US blocked that condemnation. And the response that Miller gave was, well, you know, that's a flimsy excuse. They should just not do it. Now, in this context, when, again, there's the idea of retaliation, Miller's response is simply, well, Israel is a sovereign state. It's going to make that decision on its own. So you can see how the language is so different, right? It's as if, you know, Iran is not treated as a sovereign country. Israel is treated as a sovereign country. The rules apply to certain states. The rules don't apply to other states. So that's a very brief understanding of where we are.
Yeah, I mean, purely dispassionately, you could have expected maybe some response from Israel, removing all history of to October 7th. The proportionality, like, I mean, it's just wild. Our spokespeople at the White House or the Pentagon have no sense of, no civilians were targeted in this attack or killed in this attack. Compared to the bombing of Gaza that's been going on, this is like classic rules of war kind of stuff. It's maddening to me as a commentator. I mean, I'm curious if you have any thoughts.
Well, actually, that's a really important point, because one of the things to keep in mind, and the Jordanian foreign minister actually said this as well, is this is not about Iran. Like, that's not the central conflict. This is about what is happening in Gaza. That is the central conflict. This is a distraction from that, a very easily avoidable distraction. And so the question becomes, who does it benefit to have a larger conflict? Despite the horrendous way in which this administration has approached Israel's war on Gaza, which is essentially to give it a green light to do anything it wants, which is why Israel is currently facing trial at the world's highest court for genocide charges. It's the Biden administration still doesn't necessarily want a larger war, which is why you heard this rhetoric immediately from the administration of, you know, we wouldn't support an offensive war, an offensive action by Israel. Now, that's something that the administration is saying, but nothing in its actions in the last 6 months would lead someone to believe that there's some kind of line that's actually going to be drawn in the sand. The fact that Iran's consulate was bombed by Israel in the middle of this war in Gaza should tell you a little bit about what the intention of it was in ways, because what's happened the last several days? Everyone is talking about this fear of, you know, World War III, what's going to happen with Iran? Is Israel going to retaliate? Look at this attack that happened to Israel. While all simultaneously, Palestinians are still being starved. Palestinians are still being killed. You had another an Israeli missile that killed children in a playground. That will not get as much attention in this media as an Iranian missile response to an attack on its consulate that killed no one. So this is still happening. And the important thing is to understand that the context of why we're in the situation that we're in is also that war, right? It is what Israel is doing in Gaza that is creating the instability within the region, this tension within the region. That is the core cause. And the core cause of why there is a war in Gaza right now is Israel's decades-long occupation. These are all the things that no one wants to talk about, and at least not in this administration or in this media. And that's why they don't want to talk about anything that happened before October 7th. Because if you were to do that, you'd have to actually understand why we are where we are. It's much easier to point fingers as soon as there's an attack on Israel. That becomes all of the shift in attention, not the ongoing war in Gaza, the devastation and destruction to Palestinian life there, as well as decades of occupation.
You know, and I think that it also has to be noted that the way that, you know, I don't know, at this point, I have a hard time, you know, believing a lot of the statements that we're getting from this government when it comes to their concern about, you know, loss of civilian life in Gaza. I think we might have lost the... There we go. Sorry. no, I was just saying that, you know, I think that, you know, it's fair to sort of have some suspicion when you hear the Biden administration talk about their concern for loss of civilian life in Gaza, just given their activities since the beginning of this conflict. But, you know, it is notable that, you know, you basically are having the Biden administration coming out and saying, like, you know, trying to put some pressure to a certain degree, at least publicly saying, hey, these attacks on the consulate, that's, you know, we condemn that, to, you know, this recent killing of aid workers, you know, around the World Central Kitchen. You know, you hear these kind of claims from the Biden administration, and even on this, you know, some of the kind of private cables that we've heard sort of leaked. You have to wonder, though, for somebody like Netanyahu, who I think very much would like to see this conflict maybe broaden, you know, what threat or worry they have about the Biden administration, because whenever the Biden administration sort of puts any pressure or says anything on Israel, you know, Israel just sort of bulldozes over it. And I'm curious, you know, if you think that this is something that is like a kind of calculation on Netanyahu's, you know, side, that, like, you know, basically the Biden administration is unwilling to sort of challenge them. So, yeah, they might complain about this and we have to be careful about how much we push. But basically there is no restriction coming from the United States government in terms of their support for their activities in Gaza.
I think overall what we've seen is no restraints or restrictions on Israel's behavior. That being said, when there was, so we have an election coming up in the US. And this war is hurting Biden's ability to get reelected. And that's been seen in the fact that you have protesters at almost every election, like Biden event, whether it's Biden himself or other officials, Democratic officials. You can see it in the uncommitted campaigns and the voting campaigns. And these are in key swing states where Biden's margin of victory in 2020 was not very high, right? It was within the number of votes that we're seeing now voting uncommitted. So there's a very high risk of him losing re-election because of his support for Israel and what it's doing right now. And so there's some, you know, worry, I guess you could say, especially when there's a lot of attention on something. So for instance, when, you know, while 200 aid workers have been killed in the last 6 months, the most in any conflict, there was very little pushback or noise or media attention and very little pushback from the Biden administration. However, when it was World Central Kitchen workers, which have, you know, a more known aid group.
Well, especially in DC, yeah.
Exactly, right? So basically when you have a sort of celebrity status of someone who can draw attention to what's happening and suddenly everybody is covering it and suddenly everybody is condemning it, it put pressure on the Biden admin to actually act. And what we saw is even mild pressure will get something done. So Biden picked up a phone, had a call with Netanyahu, and suddenly crossings were opened. More trucks were being allowed in and bakeries were reopened. Well, this tells us several things. Number one, it tells us that Israel was blocking aid, that Israel was intentionally starving people and continues to do so, right? Because repeatedly we were told, well, Israel isn't doing this deliberately, yet a phone call opens the doors a little bit more, gives a little bit more aid. So there's on one side the fact that if Biden really wanted to do something, he could, he absolutely has the power to. You could condition military aid. You could stop weapons transfers. You could actually allow the international system to work the way it is supposed to. You could stop, after we stopped vetoing UN resolutions, we decided to call them non-binding. I mean, the extent, the extreme to which this administration is going to protect Israel is, I think, very short-sighted, not only in the human catastrophe and loss of what we are seeing in Gaza, but even more broadly than that, how it is affecting the entire concept of the international system. You cannot invoke that very system, which somehow they still do, right? As soon as the Iranian attack in response to Israel's attack takes place, you see Israel invoking international law and going to the United Nations, which it has called Hamas for the last 6 months. So I mean, when you're watching these things unfold, yes, the Biden administration has tons of levers of power. I didn't even mention punitive ones. Those aren't punitive, right? That's not sanctions. That's not, we're going to do something actually that's going to harm you. That's just, we're not going to stand in the way of the international community, and we're not going to give you our weapons and money unless you follow international law. And by the way, that's also domestic US law. That's what we're asking the Biden administration to do. Follow international law and domestic US law. So far, they haven't done it. So I think, yeah, you see in the current Israeli government, the idea that there's a free pass to do whatever they want.
Yeah, I mean, the we're not going to help out any offensive operations thing might ring a bell, because Biden said that about the Saudis earlier, and like the response and how we basically shot down all these incoming missiles or drones or whatever, like that we're, if we still say, well, we're going to continue stocking up Iron Dome regardless, like Iron Dome is such on top of technology, like a propaganda object. Because if you call it the Impunity Dome, I think people would understand a little bit more of what people are dealing with. But I think those things have to be on the table and we shouldn't get too excited about crediting Biden with saying, we're not going to help you with any offensive things after that.
No, I mean, and I agree. The idea, I don't think, is to necessarily credit the administration for doing the bare minimum of anything. But more so, I think it suggests that this administration also does not want to see further escalation, right? I think that's a conclusion. That's a fair conclusion to draw. Whether or not they get, the problem is you know, the intention doesn't match the actions. So just saying we're not going to support Israel in an offensive attack does not actually stop that from happening, because you're not using any real pressure to ensure that that doesn't happen, which he has the power to do.
So I want to talk about something domestic in a second, but first I just did want to ask, I mean, Iran has come out with a statement basically saying, we view this as a done. This was a retaliation. Again, and they're also very clear to say, like, this is within international law or whatever. I'm not a scholar of that. I can't speak to it. But they're saying that, you know, we respond to attack on ourselves, and we see this done. I mean, you know, do you think that is like that's valid? Do you think that Iran is sort of hoping to sort of be able to put this in the past, or do you think that there might be more escalation as a sort of what we're hearing from people who are adamant defenders of Israel, for example?
I think you can, you can take the action itself, not necessarily taking them for their word, but the response was, despite it being unprecedented, was still measured, right? The fact that it was telegraphed, the fact that, there was fair warning of what was going to happen, and the weapons that were used were all, I mean, this is what the US and Israel are saying themselves. They were almost entirely intercepted, right? So that doesn't seem like the action of a state that's trying to escalate a conflict. And you can see that also not only in this, but you can see it over the last 6 months, right? There's been very measured responses. I mean, from the very early days, there was concern, oh, well, this is going to break out into an entire regional war. But it hasn't, because, and it's not just Iran, it's everyone in the region, right? Everyone in the region is trying to prevent that from happening, because they're very well aware that it doesn't benefit anybody for that to happen, right? It's going to cause a lot more instability, destruction. And these events are unpredictable by their nature. So it really just requires one miscalculation to sort of get us in a situation that's going to be a lot harder to get out of. I mean, in terms of, would this be a done deal? Something that's interesting to me is, why not just condemn Israel's action in Syria? Why not just do that? If that's what they were saying, which they did before this action was taken place, Iran said, if the United Nations condemns this, there's no reason for a response. Because they want to essentially say that Israel does not have a green light to do anything it wants. It has to be held to some standard. It has to be held to some standard that everybody has to be held to, right? It's not unique to Israel. This is the same standard by which Iran should be held, as well as the United States, Russia, any state we're talking about. That's the entire point of international law. But from the US perspective, I wonder what would have been the downside to just saying, yeah, let the UN condemn this action. What if that had prevented this attack? What if that would have been de-escalation, right? What if you didn't use, there's a report I read, something like $1 billion was spent intercepting these missiles and drones. What if we didn't waste resources in that way? And just, if all it took was a condemnation from the United Nations for something that should be condemned, what would have been the problem? Mm-hmm. So it's also hard to take them for their word. We don't want to escalate anything, but our actions create the conditions for escalation.
Before you move on, I'm curious, and maybe it's too early to judge this thing. So if that's the case, fine. But have you noticed anything as far as reception for this retaliation, whether it's, you know, at the highest levels of government in the region or within the people anywhere? Is there anything like how, because we had, you know, Matt Duss on Majority Report today, and unsurprisingly, his read of the blob in D.C. is that they see this as leading to more sympathy for Israel. But I'm curious, outside of the D.C. sort of military industrial complex, like how is this being received?
I think outside, it's not just D.C. I think that kind of narrative resonates with the sort of Western world. And the reason for that is because of the way that the narrative is presented, right? The fact that Western leaders, not just in the U.S., but led by the U.S. essentially, react so differently to the such immediate condemnation, so much attention in a situation where there were zero casualties compared to a plausible genocide. How do you reconcile that? How do you react worse to no one dying than you do to 35,000 people dying, to 14,000 children dying? There's no explanation for that. And then the media narrative just sort of parrots whatever the leadership is saying as well. So I think outside of that, no, this doesn't change for the global South, for the majority of the world that has been watching the horrors unfold in Gaza for months. I don't think this changes their view, like suddenly, well, never mind, it's okay to commit genocide. That's not going to be the thinking. But for the media, the mainstream media and leadership in the Western world that was essentially trying to avoid any accountability for Israel, it gives them an opening. Mm-hmm. Right, it gives an opening to be able to point a finger to say, well, this is why we have to give weapons to Israel. See? But the context that's missing is, but Iran was responding to an action that Israel took. That's the missing context. And that's the missing context when you look at the war on Gaza, right? All the context has to be missing. You can't talk about before October 7th because you can only talk about where Israel is reacting to something. You can't talk about what happened before.
Well, I mean, it's always, yeah. I mean, you know, I was listening to The Daily earlier about the attacks, and it's just like the dramatization of the strike by Iran was just something, knowing the way that, you know, what's been going on in Gaza has been sort of covered, you know, very emotional. There's a kind of backtrack of like a heartbeat, you know. And anyways, for that group of folks, you know, I don't know, have too many words for them, but I did want to ask you to respond to something, because it is something that I was seeing sort of rhetorically used, and in the past we've talked about the way that Iranian women are oftentimes used in the media by folks who like might want to see war and conflict, and you saw that just play out. I mean, almost to a T regarding these strikes, where. You know, can't speak for everybody online, but basically I think most people with heads on their shoulders are saying, hey, let's do everything that we can to make sure that this doesn't escalate into like a massive regional conflict. And some of the most bloodthirsty and wild folks out there on that kind of, you know, liberal pro-democratic party side were saying, I can't believe that the progressive left now supports, you know, the Islamic Republic as they are, you know, doing all these horrific things to women. You know, and the implication is that, you know, America sort of responding and maybe getting involved with an Israeli attack on Iran is somehow going to help out the women in Iran. Anyway, I mean, I've front-loaded this a little bit, but I'm just curious if you could respond to this kind of claim that like folks out there who were saying, hey, let's de-escalate, are somehow now doing the handiwork of the Islamic Republic.
So unfortunately, when you have sort of hawkish voices who have long, I mean, for decades have wanted war with Iran. these are the opportunities that are sort of obvious to capitalize on. And here's the thing, it doesn't, the fact that Iran is a sovereign country that should be following international law, and that if its consulate or embassy is attacked, that is a violation of international law, does not take away from the repressive nature of an authoritarian government which rules domestically within Iran, right? These are, they're not mutually exclusive. It's not because, because Israel's action against an Iranian embassy complex is illegal, that means now all of the Iranian government's actions are okay. It's a very bizarre way of trying to frame the issue, in the same way that we would never, that just wouldn't be the case anywhere, right? We would never think, the issues are not interrelated. If the US, if a US consulate was attacked, there would be no question about the illegality of that action and the fact that the US has a right to respond to it, right? Now, how that response would be, that's something one could debate, right? If our response is disproportionate, then that is a problem. That's something that can be taken up within the you know, confines of international law. But if someone said, well, it's okay that the consulate of the United States was attacked because look at its record of war crimes, that wouldn't make any sense, right? It doesn't make sense to conflate every issue together. Yes, the Iranian government is an authoritarian government which represses its own people. There's no question to that fact. That does not mean that any country can go and blow up embassies. These two things are not directly related, but there's an attempt to do that, to say it's okay to break international law because those are the bad guys, and it's okay when we break international law because we're the good guys. Like, that's not, that's no longer international law. And by making, by undermining the entire premise of it in this manner, we make it more difficult to hold states like Iran accountable. And that's the problem with doing it.
I was going to say the good guys, it's like looking, who is the good guy and who is the bad guy, and then getting upset when people say, well, you know, there's actually a bunch of things we need to consider when discussing this stuff. But yeah, you beat me to it.
Yeah, no, I mean, just the fact that you would frame the good guy as the one plausibly committing genocide is odd in and of itself, right?
Eyebrow raising.
The laundry list of crimes that Israel has committed in the last 6 months and has committed within the last many decades is really unbelievable to look at, and then with a straight face say, but they're the good guys, so they're allowed to now break international law. That's the whole, that's what made, that's the problem. The problem is they've been breaking international law for such a long, for all of this time. Occupation, the occupation of Palestinian lands and territories is not legal. Annexing land is not legal. Detaining children, putting them in under military courts, expanding settlements, sanctioning settler violence against Palestinians. I mean, the list is so long, it's difficult to even articulate. So our argument is they're allowed to break international law because, no, there's no argument. There's no argument behind it. The reason they're allowed to do it is because the most powerful country in the world lets them do it, because nobody holds us accountable. So we can decide who is held accountable, and we decide that that's not going to be the state of Israel.
You know, I mean, and again, it's extremely rich, that Israel basically went crying to the United Nations after the strike, after the way that they've talked about, you know, the United Nations, as you noted, you know, effectively calling them Hamas. And I will say, look, I don't want to be here and be starry-eyed, because we know the world that we live in, and we know how, like, the international community and international law sort of played out in a lot of places. But I mean, this probably, I just have to ask you, somebody who knows more of the history than I do. I mean, what we are seeing right now in Gaza, in Palestine, two Palestinians, I mean, I really can't think of another example in at least recent history where, like, international law and international standards have not only been ignored, but in just such a blatant and public way as what we're watching right now with this mass slaughter of Gaza. I mean, is that a fair categorization?
I think it's quite fair. Yeah, I think obviously, you know, I would never make the argument. And sometimes when you talk about what's happening in Gaza in this way, it makes it sound like international law and the international system was working out great beforehand, and all of a sudden this happened. That's not the case, right? It's the double standards and hypocrisy within the Western world they've always existed, right? Because the idea that we've sort of moved past a history of colonialism, the idea that we've moved past things like Orientalism, like we don't have racism informing the way that we think about things. I mean, ultimately, when it comes down to it, is how do you reconcile these issues? Well, when you dehumanize an entire population, when you decide those people are not really people, and we've done this historically as human beings many times to justify atrocities, to justify crimes against humanity, to justify genocide. So that's the same language that's being used today. We just shift it to fit the historical context that we find ourselves in. So we love to talk about things like international law. The United States champions international law. In fact, this administration, if we remember, right? If we remember, Biden becomes president and says, America's back. What did he mean? He meant that his predecessor did not follow international norms. This was one of the most significant criticisms that Biden had of Donald Trump. And yet, this administration has shred international law in a way that I don't think this brazenly have we seen before.
I mean, like, really, I'm not going to ask you to get into Biden's mind, but like, it really is amazing, you know, as somebody who's a vice president under Obama, and like, you know, millions of problems with the Obama administration. Everyone who's been watching this program and knows my politics knows that's what I think. But Lord, you know, when you look at like Obama's kind of like foreign policy achievements, you know, trying to de-escalate with Iran, normalizing relations with Cuba, you know, just like the lack of appetite or interest that Joe Biden has for trying to resurrect those things that were, you know, attacked by Donald Trump. You know, it, just on a political level, it's just bizarre to watch somebody who could very easily say, look, we're restoring the good job that we were doing, you know, restoring America, whatever, and just running away from it. In fact, like embracing a lot of, you know, some of the most dangerous and warmongering tendencies of the Trump administration.
I would even push back a little bit and say that the Trump at least the president himself was not as war. In fact, one of the appeals of Trump for a lot of people was he sort of has an anti-war stance, right? Now, I say that, and his policies, just like I said, it doesn't matter what you say, it matters what your policies are. It is the Trump administration that pulled out of the nuclear deal with Iran. It is the Trump administration that assassinated Qasem Soleimani and brought us to another very, very tense moment, right? So I'm not trying to paint a picture as, you know, he didn't do anything wrong in terms of his foreign policy. He certainly did. But arguably, he was less inclined towards war than what we have seen under the Trump administration. I mean, under the Biden administration. So it's... I don't understand the psyche of Joe Biden either. It is interesting that so many of his policies tend to be more similar to his predecessor than to the president which he served under, Barack Obama, right? So it is sort of weird to watch. And I don't know if it's just a tendency within DC politics to maintain the status quo, even if the status quo was something worse off than what you had. So it just seems like that seems to be the logic that's informing it, just maintaining things as they are and not shaking things up a lot.
Well, I don't know if you saw that there was that video of people chanting Genocide Joe at a Trump rally.
Well, that's, you know, the thing is, yeah. Trump won the primary in 2016 saying the Iraq war was a big fat mistake. Like the popular sentiment, you actually can win on that sort of generic anti-war thing. And Trump knows that. Whether he falls through on it, like you said, is a different question.
Yeah,
but, I mean, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I mean, it is interesting to see the sort of on the Republican right-wing side that has traditionally been very, very supportive of Israel, very, very supportive of Israel. Now you're actually seeing some criticism. Now, what is the reasoning behind it? Does it serve a political purpose? Well, certainly, right? There's an election coming up. So there's a very interesting sort of balance in how someone like Trump is trying to still maintain his very staunch support for Israel while also being critical of Biden's policy on Gaza. So watching navigating that space is interesting in and of itself, but I do think that there's a political element behind it, right? Mm-hmm. Try to make Biden look bad. As long as they're saying, when they're chanting Genocide Joe, I saw that clip too. Mm-hmm. You sort of see Trump pause.
Look, what a gift that I've been given. And again, it is a gift that has been given. Everything that you've seen from the Biden administration, I mean, it is deliberate choices by them, to create the situation.
Absolutely.
Saul, I really do appreciate you spending some time with us this evening. We always love speaking with you. Folks, there are links below to go and follow Saul's work. Really appreciate it and hope to have you on again sometime soon.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, guys.
Of course.
Thanks, Saul.
Yeah, that was really great. That's Saul Rod. Again, there are links below. That's somebody who should definitely be keeping in, following on Twitter and reading their work. It's really excellent.
Yeah, really, if you're on Twitter for the network, like I still am, and both David and I are, she's somebody you should be there for.
Oh no, that's somebody. That's somebody who, you know, I'm so happy that I've been able to, you know, cross paths with somebody like that. And that's a nice thing about that really messed up platform, which, you know, I wanted to talk about this a little bit, Matt. I mean, it is extremely worrying as what we were seeing over the weekend, as all of us were worrying about, you know, potential escalation, and not acting like we're out of the woods or anything like that yet. Well, it was an extremely worrying time. And going on this website where a lot of people go to check out this news when it's something like this breaks, and seeing like Alex Jones and Alex Jones associated or people in his network tweeting out videos of rubble and basically being like, oh, look what happened, you know? And, it's extremely worrying to see that kind of disinformation, but also know that it's being fucking boosted under this new system, under Elon Musk's Twitter. That, like, the people who are running this site are so goddamn irresponsible, have no care or interest or worry about what happens, when you start pumping out disinformation. I mean, there was videos, you know, there's been so much misinformation this past week. There was another one where people were talking about Tehran, you know, a bomb just exploded in the middle of Tehran, the capital of Iran. I mean, that's really worrying, stuff to be propagated. And like, you know, sometimes I roll my eyes a little bit about the people getting really worked up about, you know, what's going on the computer, on Twitter and things like that. Because there is a kind of, you know, especially for people like us, Matt, you know, there can be a little bit of a narcissism there since we, you know, spend a lot of time and do that kind of work. That's extremely dangerous stuff, not just for like our democracy, but for the globe when that stuff is being, you know, sort of pumped out.
Yeah, I mean, there's in communication studies, which is what I majored in, two concepts, signal and noise. And when it becomes easier to tap into a signal, for instance, it isn't based on AM frequency available in a limited region or a limited number of television channels, but like something like the internet, it becomes much easier for people to like notice things about, say, the Israel-Palestine issue or whatever, mm-hmm. and how corporations run businesses and treat labor forces and stuff like that. So noise needs to be added to the mix. And that's what's happening with Twitter. It's been degraded by a very powerful man into less signal and more noise. And whether it's been done intentionally or, I think, yes, like this is how this degradation of Twitter, which like before Elon existed, wasn't great, but it would be the place I would go to try to source like breaking video, mm-hmm. For instance, or new reactions. And it is simply not that, particularly in video, which makes it every time Elon says, we're doing a pivot to video, it's now a video platform. It's gotten way worse for that. Anybody in this a business that won't tell you that probably pays for a Twitter premium and is glazing the guy. But yeah, I mean, it sucks. It sucks a lot because, you know, it's kind of tied to our ability to get our message out there, that it's lousy with Nazis, and that's becoming more and more people's experience with it.
Yeah. And, just a quick programming note, in just a little bit, we're going to be talking a bit about, that character, Elon Musk, and something that's been going on, with his car company, which is at least affecting my immediate area. So you won't want to miss that. You get that at patreon.com/leftreckoning. In the post game, we'll also be taking questions and calls. But before we get there, phone line's still not working. So just questions in the Discord, but we will be hearing from all of y'all there. But before we get there, I know we want to talk about something else before running over to the other side.
Yeah, so I played Rua Benjamin at Spelman speaking out for student activists. And That is a pinprick of light in a very dark moment. And here's a news segment here, and I'm going to play this. It's slightly sped up to try to avoid copyright, but we need to comment on how this is being portrayed and received by the media as much as actually just stand with this student here who did nothing wrong, including the Instagram post that Zionists took issue with, which we'll look at in depth because it's being censored. But here is how this, I think NBC News Channel 4 is covering this.
Yeah, Colleen, USC made this decision several hours ago, citing student safety. Now, this all started over the past several days. USC says there have been concerning conversations about their selection of the valedictorian and how this could threaten the campus safety. And while they can't comment if they've received any threats specifically, they say the ongoing conflict in the Middle East has led to harassment and violence on other campuses. Now, shortly after USC...
Now, let's just break that down a little bit, this threat of violence. And who is the implied violent actor here? Oh, well, actually, let's just let this go a little bit further, and maybe I'll comment on after that.
24 valedictorian Osna Tabassum, a fourth-year student from Chino Hills with a major in biomedical engineering and a minor in resistance to genocide. There were calls for the university to reconsider their decision. Several organizations asked for USC to remove her as valedictorian because of a link on her social media account that they say contains anti-Semitic language. I spoke to Tabassum, who is a first-generation South Asian American Muslim. She tells me she's disappointed by the school's decision to not speak at the graduation and calls this a campaign of hate.
So, after several organizations, not named, maybe name those, maybe name the organizations that got this student booted off from being valedictorian, complained that she had some anti-Semitic stuff on her Instagram. I have that here. The Zionist smear. Let me make sure my DMs are closer. channel here. Posted this, and I'll just make this big here. Let me swap with David. Breaking: USC valedictorian Osna Tabassum will not be allowed to speak during commencement after outrage ensued following her authoring an anti-Semitic social media post on her Instagram. David Bernstein, and you know, if you look at David Bernstein's bio, classified, the untold story of racial classification in America. Oh, he's blurred by George Will. So even if you didn't know he's a George Mason guy, you know he's a proper asshole prick. And he's been smearing students this entire time. Fuck this guy. But stop. He asks, "What can someone give me a link to what you said like that causes controversy?" Here this is. So we're going to make this big here. So there she is. She's private on Instagram. Maybe I can make this a little bit bigger for folks. Private on Instagram here. And she has this card here. I've never heard of card, but Palestine. Learn about what's happening in Palestine and how you can help. Introduction, basic stuff. Palestine is a country located in the Levant in Western Asia, borders Lebanon, Syria, Jordan. Currently, it has been occupied by the state of Israel, a Jewish ethnic state established by Zionists in 1948. Tell some stuff about where to get other sources there. We'll skip a little bit ahead. Contents, basics. Here's a part. Let's see if we can find any anti-Semitism in this. What are the two solutions? Two-state solution advocates for both Israel and Palestine to exist alongside one another as sovereign states. However, the solution is not really a solution at all because it is merely another form of Zionism. I agree with that. That's why we support a one-state solution here, but they also say one-state solution advocates for one state in which both Arabs and Jews can live together. However, a one-state solution under the Israeli government would essentially mean that Palestinian people would completely be under the state of Israel in every way imaginable. They continue. One Palestinian state would mean Palestine liberation and the complete abolition of the state of Israel. This way is the only way towards justice. Both Arabs and Jews can live together without an ideology that specifically advocates for the ethnic cleansing of one of them. Palestinians would be allowed to return home, and millions of Palestinians would not have to live under occupation apartheid. Let's just scan a little bit further, see if there's anything else. Books, just recommend some books there. I've read several of those. I don't recognize any of those people to be anti-Semites. I recognize basically all of them. History, just some history stuff here. Palestine, again, like this is all basic stuff. The beginning of Zionist colonization, it talks about like the, I mean, this is just facts. And if anybody, like I challenge anybody to talk about like any problem here. Nonetheless, I mean, let's just let this play out a little bit more because this student had to run away from this, that card even, which again, I don't think said anything anti-Semitic. And I say that, you know, I think it pretty comfortably, but let's just let this go a little bit further.
USC released a community message on their decision, saying in part, the decision is not only necessary to maintain the safety of our campus and students, but it is consistent with a fundamental legal obligation, including the expectations of federal regulators that universities act to protect students and keep our campus community safe. It applies the same values and criteria that we have used in the past to guide our actions. In no way does it diminish the remarkable academic achievements of any student considered or selected for valedictorian. To be clear, this decision has nothing to do with freedom of speech. There is no free speech.
Everything to do with that.
How is not speaking at graduation not a diminishment of your achievements? That would have been one of the achievements. And let's be clear about this threat of violence. I am unaware of Zionist students being attacked. That would be bad. I am aware of students, say, in Vermont. Three students supporting Palestine got shot in Burlington, Vermont because of that. Like, that's who this violence is about. This so-called security threat emerged after this young lady, who is a minor in genocide studies and valedictorian, was placed as speaker by after Zionist groups smeared her as anti-Semitic. The threat to security is from Zionists, if it exists at all. And it should be one that that any college should be willing to face. You should have her up there. And if you need extra security because we can't trust Zionists not to do anything and disruptive, then you deal with them then. But like this idea, because I think what's implied here when they say, oh, it's a safety thing, like some sort of car bombing is going to happen by some Hamas.
100%. Right? And I'm sorry, I think it's important, to talk about, that implication, what group is being implied here. It's certainly not the people supporting the genocide. It's the people who are opposing it. And two, you look at like my hometown, you know, where I live, where there was a brutal stabbing of a young Palestinian outside after a Palestinian march, right by the University of Texas's campus, right? Something that has now been recognized as a hate crime. And that person was stabbed because they were marching for a free Palestine. Now, what has been the response from the state government and the University of Texas system? In fact, it has been Greg Abbott making an executive order demanding that Texas universities accept and use this hyper-reactionary definition of anti-Semitism, which conflates any kind of criticism of the state of Israel with anti-Semitism, right? Talking about this about, again, and using the same kind of language of in response to safety concerns, not the safety concerns of the 35,000 plus who have now been murdered by the Israeli government, not the safety concerns of Palestinian Americans here in Texas and all across this country, it's a way to attack speech. And what we're seeing is I think one of the more egregious examples of the attack on basic democratic principles, rights of freedom of speech in this country. Every single university administrator who participates in that should be ashamed of what yep. they're doing.
Yeah. Let's just play this a little bit more here. There's some else I want to comment on.
At a commencement, the issue here is how best to maintain campus security and safety, period. Tabassum also released a statement saying in part, as your class valedictorian, I implore my USC classmates to think outside the box, to work towards a world that cries for equality and human dignity are not manipulated to be expressions of hatred. I challenge us to respond to ideological discomfort with dialogue and learning, not bigotry and censorship. And I urge us to see past our deepest fears and recognize the need to support justice for all, including the Palestinian people. The director of Campus Rights Advocacy for the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression, a free speech group, Alex Morey, commented on USC's decision.
They will help themselves by adopting positions of, for example, institutional neutrality, where they say, we're not going to take political sides one way or the other, and also by standing by their really strong free speech principles in every instance, so that when something really controversial like this pops up, students, faculty, they know where USC is going to stand.
Now, I wanted to include that because I have a little bit of heat for these organizations. Fire. I think that statement is atrocious. To say you got yourself into this, implying that there's been a earlier failing. Like, here's the thing: to say this is actually controversial, and these previous things that people have been upset about on campuses aren't, is to me that's about you and maybe your hangups ideologically. Because what I read, and maybe I'm being too sensitive here, but is that when students complain about, say, Charles Murray doing IQ science on campus, that if administrators don't stand up for that, then what can they complain when something like this happens? Now, both of those, Charles Murray's bell curve shit and Zionism, are racist ideas. Whether to say one is controversial and one isn't, I think is a problem. And I think, like, I think we need to reckon with the fact that these sort of free speech organizations, going back to Index on Censorship, when Noam Chomsky had an issue with them in the 70s because of criticism of Israel, what PEN America or the PEN Foundation is going through right now, which is supposed to be a free speech organization, but again, like criticizing people and throwing people under the bus for support of Palestine. This cannot be a simple, you have to support whoever saying whatever. You have to say that what this young lady is saying is righteous and should be allowed there. And if you should allow unrighteous speech elsewhere, that's fine. But this sort of pussyfooting around, like, I have a big problem with this. And I think it's symptomatic for how this fight gets lost. And I think, maybe this is a little bit tangential, but I really think free speech people need to get their shit together when it comes to this stuff.
The fact is that, like, the free speech people, maybe that's a position that was evacuated, by certain members of the left. Maybe that might be a criticism you could make. The people who have been engaging in that, oh, well, I'm a free speech person. I mean, it's never been about, like, free speech. It's always been selective as to, oh, I want to come and, support whatever this kind of new right wing formation that was kind of bubble up, well-funded, show up on campus and, like, cause a big scene. The idea that, like, oh, well, now these kids are going to learn their lesson is ludicrous. Matt and I, I'm 30. When I was in school, 12 years ago, what happened to me and other groups like the groups I was a member of, groups like Students for Justice in Palestine, how did the university react to activities that we were involved in? With an iron fist, all kinds of activities from, putting up posters, showing demonstrations. We were treated with the same kind of contempt and attempts by the university officials to shut those groups down. Why? Because, when you say that, Israel shouldn't have the right to be able to hold people in an open air prison, shouldn't be able to maintain illegal occupation of the West Bank, you are making students who believe in Zionism feel unsafe, right? So the idea that, like, oh, well, look how the tables have turned, and now, pro-human rights speech on university campuses is being stomped because of the excesses. I think that's a very glib and incorrect position. Now, I think that there is, some truth to a kind of recognition that, if you give university administrators, I think have shown themselves time and time again, it is a fundamental fact of the American university. That is not a group of people who are radicals. Despite all the kind of talk about the university systems being filled with radicals, look, you can fucking talk until the end of the earth about whether or not you think liberals or conservatives are overrepresented in this side or not, right? Is Hollywood liberal or is Hollywood conservative? I don't know. It's one of those things that just, like, to sit there and really try to have, like, a scientific answer to it, you're not going to get there. But do you know what is clear? Is the people who run universities, which effectively in this country have become a business, what do businesses do? Well, they want to make sure that university is continuing to, to maintain itself, to pull in money and to be successful financially. What do you do if you want to make sure that your institution is successful financially? Well, I don't want to anger powerful and wealthy people. So university administrative positions do not encourage or do not seek out radicals or people who are going to potentially upend or create crisis at their universities, right?
Because look at how Bill Ackman, like, has thrown the entire Ivy League into a tizzy.
No, 100%. I mean, the whole idea here that the universities are basically controlled by this, like, radical, group of folks, it is absolutely ludicrous. Now, look, I have 10 million criticisms of the left. I think there's a lot of people who don't recognize that, yes, if you spend a lot of time and sort of, like, encouraging the state, or the bosses or all any kind of, like, authority thing to start, like, figuring out what is good to say and what is bad to say, that is going to get really dangerous really fast. Cause I'm sorry, we are already in a position where our political perspective is marginalized, has been, it is one of those things. I mean, when I was in school too, the idea of being able to be out in the world as, like, an out socialist, just seemed ludicrous because in American business culture, or professional culture, even in you know, radical, even in kind of like advocacy, social justice groups, you weren't supposed to be that, right? So like 100% in this country, it's not like we've been living in some kind of period of like, you know, freedom of speech, you know, for the past few decades. No, absolutely not. But, you know, again, we have to be very careful of, you know, whether or not we want to make those systems feel more confident and more comfortable with utilizing that power. And I think, you know, the way to do that is by, yeah, talking very materially about what these positions are, Matt. And I think that that is something, too, where oftentimes, look, if we're supposed to be Marxists, that means we're materialists. And oftentimes, whenever we talk about speech, everything becomes very, like, idealist and abstracted. Are you a free speech absolutist or what? You know, and actually look fundamentally at what it is that we're talking about, you know, who's saying what and doing what and to whom. And, you know, that's, will start to make things a little bit clearer for you. So, you know, I think that it's something right to flag, because there is 100% an attempt right now, to, it's not like, oh, it just started. It's been going on for a long time. Right. I think it's this, it is because of the critical nature of the moment that we are in, that the authority figures, be they university administrators, be they the governor of your state, are playing an extra role in trying to suppress and attack free speech in this country. And that's an extremely dangerous thing. And to, you know, some of our American friends who do want to like favor more of an environment where speech can be attacked, you know, look to our comrades in Europe, particularly in Germany, who, you know, some of our friends who are bravely standing up right now and are facing all kinds of consequences for that. You know, not to get all fucking, you know, Yankee Doodle over here, but, you know, freedom of speech is a left wing and a socialist value. Yes. And it's something that you should fight for, you know, and build up the capacity to challenge the reactionaries and the right.
Yeah, that reminds me of, I can't remember who it was, but one of the boys from the Brigham Young Money podcast tweeted out, because somebody at Novara had to apologize to J.K. Rowling for calling her a Holocaust denier over her denying that trans people were targeted by the Nazis, which seems to be a matter of fact to me, but I'm in America where I can say things like that. And he quote tweeted it with Mel Gibson in The Patriot, like riding a horse, like me when I see somebody giving a servile, libel avoidance statement. Yeah, it is really important, and it genuinely pays dividends just from a pro-democracy standpoint. I also just want to flag Prem Tucker, who's a great journalist, also from North Dakota. Columbia, he tweeted this out. He has a piece here ahead of a congressional testimony, Columbia student cracks down on student advocacy. Columbia hired private investigators to pursue pro-Palestine students, still hasn't opened a case in the 88-day-old chemical attack. That is absurd. Wow. Vanderbilt, I think IDF people on campus, Vanderbilt canceled divestment vote, expelled students after they protested. Pomona sent dozens of riot police to arrest 20 students. So, and I mean, our boy Yanis Varoufakis, and a whole bunch of Palestine, like you mentioned, in Germany. I mean, we are seeing an absolute assault, and it is on lines that we have seen this assault coming from, because, again, like, all this was preceded by BDS and the sort of insane legislative assault on that. And it's, yeah, it is time to, I mean, I played that up top, the Rua Benjamin speech. Like, we need way more of that because we're seeing a lot of cowardice unfolding by these administrators.
Yes, 100%. You know, there's only so much speech that we can do on this side of it. If you want to come into the real free speech zone, no holds barred side of it, come to the postgame 165. Matt and I will be taking y'all's questions from the Discord. We also have some fun video and things like that for all of y'all. We're going to be talking about everyone's favorite boy, Elon Musk. You won't want to miss that. We'll be over there in just a couple minutes. Thank you so much to Matt. And thank you to Saul for joining us. It's always wonderful having people like that on this program. Everyone, we appreciate you so much, and come hang out with us, patreon.com/leftreckoning, to see it.